If people are dieting now more than ever before, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that, instead of turning into fat when you consume it, turns into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. So, by getting more MCTs in your diet, you essentially flip a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which can flush out excess fat and calories. And he's created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. I love how incredible it tastes. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized. So, if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to GundryMD.com/energy and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/energy.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Chapter 10 of Part 4 of The Idiot, Parts 3 and 4 by Fyodor Dostoevsky. Translated by Eva M. Martin. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The prince did not die before his wedding, either by day or night, as he had foretold that he might. Very probably he passed disturbed nights and was afflicted with bad dreams, but during the daytime, among his fellow men, he seemed as kind as ever and even contented, only a little thoughtful when alone. The wedding was hurried on. The day was fixed for exactly a week after Evgeny's visit to the prince. In the face of such haste as this, even the prince's best friends, if he had had any, would have felt the hopelessness of any attempt to save the poor madman. Rumour said that in the visit of Evgeny Pavlovitch was to be discerned the influence of Lizabetha Prokofievna and her husband. But if those good souls, in the boundless kindness of their hearts, were desirous of saving the eccentric young fellow from ruin, they were unable to take any stronger measures to attain that end. Neither their position nor their private inclination, perhaps, and only naturally, would allow them to use any more pronounced means. We have observed before that even some of the prince's nearest neighbours had begun to oppose him. Vera Lebedev's passive disagreement was limited to the shedding of a few solitary tears, to more frequent sitting alone at home, and to a diminished frequency in her visits to the prince's apartments. Kolya was occupied with his father at this time. The old man died during a second stroke, which took place just 8 days after the first. The prince showed great sympathy in the grief of the family, and during the first days of their mourning he was at the house a great deal with Nina Alexandrovna. He went to the funeral, and it was observable that the public assembled in church greeted his arrival and departure with whisperings, and watched him closely. The same thing happened in the park and in the street, wherever he went. He was pointed out when he drove by, and he often overheard the name of Nastasia Philipovna coupled with his own as he passed. People looked out for her at the funeral, too, but she was not there. And another conspicuous absentee was the captain's widow, whom Lebedev had prevented from coming. The funeral service produced a great effect on the prince. He whispered to Lebedev that this was the first time he had ever heard a Russian funeral service since he was a little boy. Observing that he was looking about him uneasily, Lebedev asked him whom he was seeking. Nothing. I only thought I...
Is it Rogojin?
Why, is he here?
Yes, he's in church.
I thought I caught sight of his eyes, muttered the prince in confusion. But what of it? Why is he here? Was he asked?
Oh, dear, no. Why, they don't even know him. Anyone can come in, you know. Why do you look so amazed? I often meet him. I've seen him at least 4 times here at Pavlovsk within the last week.
I haven't seen him once since that day, the prince murmured. As Nastasia Philipovna had not said a word about having met Rogojin since that day, the prince concluded that the latter had his own reasons for wishing to keep out of sight. All the day of the funeral, our hero was in a deeply thoughtful state, while Nastasia Philipovna was particularly merry, both in the daytime and in the evening. Kolya had made it up with the prince before his father's death, and it was he who urged him to make use of Keller and Burdovsky, promising to answer himself for the former's behavior. Nina Alexandrovna and Lebedev tried to persuade him to have the wedding in St. Petersburg instead of in the public fashion contemplated down here at Pavlovsk in the height of the season. But the prince only said that Nastasia Philipovna desired to have it so, though he saw well enough what prompted their arguments. The next day, Keller came to visit the prince. He was in a high state of delight with the post of honor assigned to him at the wedding. Before entering, he stopped on the threshold, raised his hand as if making a solemn vow, and cried, "I won't drink!" Then he went up to the prince, seized both his hands, shook them warmly, and declared that he had at first felt hostile towards the project of this marriage, and had openly said so in the billiard rooms, but that the reason simply was that, with the impatience of a friend, he had hoped to see the prince marry at least a Princess de Rohan or de Chabot, but that now he saw that the prince's way of thinking was 10 times more noble than that of all the rest put together. For he desired neither pomp nor wealth nor honour, but only the truth. The sympathies of exalted personages were well known, and the prince was too highly placed by his education, and so on, not to be in some sense an exalted personage. But all the common herd judged differently in the town, at the meetings, in the villas, at the band, in the inns, and the billiard rooms. The coming event has only to be mentioned, and there are shouts and cries from everybody. I have even heard talk of getting up a charivari under the windows on the wedding night. So if you have need of the pistol of an honest man, prince, I am ready to fire 6 shots even before you rise from your nuptial couch. Keller also advised, in anticipation of the crowd making a rush after the ceremony, that a fire hose should be placed at the entrance to the house. But Lebedev was opposed to this measure, which he said might result in the place being pulled down. "I assure you, prince, that Lebedev is intriguing against you. He wants to put you under control. Imagine that! To take from you the use of your free will and your money. That is to say, the 2 things that distinguish us from the animals. I have heard it said positively. It is the sober truth." The prince recollected that somebody had told him something of the kind before, and he had, of course, scoffed at it. He only laughed now and forgot the hint at once. Lebedev really had been busy for some little while, but as usual his plans had become too complex to succeed, through sheer excess of ardour. When he came to the prince, the very day before the wedding, to confess, for he always confessed to the persons against whom he intrigued, especially when the plan failed, he informed our hero that he himself was a born Talleyrand, but for some unknown reason had become simple Lebedev. He then proceeded to explain his whole game to the prince, interesting the latter exceedingly. According to Lebedev's account, he had first tried what he could do with General Epanchin. The latter informed him that he wished well to the unfortunate young man, and would gladly do what he could to save him, but that he did not think it would be seemly for him to interfere in this matter. Lizabetha Prokofievna would neither hear nor see him. Prince S. and Evgeny Pavlovitch only shrugged their shoulders, and implied that it was no business of theirs. However, Lebedev had not lost heart, and went off to a clever lawyer, a worthy and respectable man, whom he knew well. This old gentleman informed him that the thing was perfectly feasible, if he could get hold of competent witnesses as to Mushkin's mental incapacity.
Then, with the assistance of a few influential persons, he would soon see the matter arranged. Lebedeff immediately procured the services of an old doctor, and carried the latter away to Pavlovsk to see the prince, by way of viewing the ground, as it were, and to give him, Lebedeff, counsel as to whether the thing was to be done or not. The visit was not to be official, but merely friendly. Muishkin remembered the doctor's visit quite well. He remembered that Lebedeff had said that he looked ill and had better see a doctor, and although the prince scouted the idea, Lebedeff had turned up almost immediately with his old friend, explaining that they had just met at the bedside of Hippolyte, who was very ill, and that the doctor had something to tell the prince about the sick man. The prince had, of course, at once received him, and had plunged into a conversation about Hippolyte. He had given the doctor an account of Hippolyte's attempted suicide, and had proceeded thereafter to talk of his own malady, of Switzerland, of Schneider, and so on. And so deeply was the old man interested by the prince's conversation and his description of Schneider's system, that he sat on for 2 hours. Muishkin gave him excellent cigars to smoke, and Lebedeff, for his part, regaled him with liqueurs, brought in by Vera, to whom the doctor, a married man and the father of a family, addressed such compliments that she was filled with indignation. They parted friends, and after leaving the prince, the doctor said to Lebedeff, "If all such people were put under restraint, there would be no one left for keepers." Lebedeff then, in tragic tones, told of the approaching marriage, whereupon the other nodded his head and replied that, after all, marriages like that were not so rare, that he had heard that the lady was very fascinating and of extraordinary beauty, which was enough to explain the infatuation of a wealthy man, that, further, thanks to the liberality of Totski and of Rogojin, she possessed, so he had heard, not only money, but pearls, diamonds, shawls, and furniture, and consequently she could not be considered a bad match. In brief, it seemed to the doctor that the prince's choice, far from being a sign of foolishness, denoted, on the contrary, a shrewd, calculating, and practical mind. Lebedeff had been much struck by this point of view, and he terminated his confession by assuring the prince that he was ready, if need be, to shed his very life's blood for him. Hippolyte, too, was a source of some distraction to the prince at this time. He would send for him at any and every hour of the day. They lived, Hippolyte and his mother and the children, in a small house not far off, and the little ones were happy, if only because they were able to escape from the invalid into the garden. The prince had enough to do in keeping the peace between the irritable Hippolyte and his mother, and eventually the former became so malicious and sarcastic on the subject of the approaching wedding that Muishkin took offense at last and refused to continue his visits. A couple of days later, however, Hippolyte's mother came with tears in her eyes and begged the prince to come back, or he would eat her up bodily. She added that Hippolyte had a great secret to disclose. Of course the prince went. There was no secret, however, unless we reckon certain pantings and agitated glances around, probably all put on, as the invalid begged his visitor to beware of Rogojin. "He is the sort of man," he continued, "who won't give up his object, you know. He is not like you and me, prince. He belongs to quite a different order of beings. If he sets his heart on a thing, he won't be afraid of anything," and so on. Hippolyte was very ill, and looked as though he could not long survive. He was tearful at first, but grew more and more sarcastic and malicious as the interview proceeded. The prince questioned him in detail as to his hints about Rogojin. He was anxious to seize upon some facts which might confirm Hippolyte's vague warnings, but there were none. Only Hippolyte's own private impressions and feelings. However, the invalid, to his immense satisfaction, ended by seriously alarming the prince. At first Muishkin had not cared to make any reply to his sundry questions, and only smiled in response to Hippolyte's advice to run for his life abroad if necessary. There are Russian priests everywhere, and one can get married all over the world. But it was Hippolyte's last idea which upset him. "What I am really alarmed about, though," he said, "is Aglaya Ivanovna. Rogojin knows how you love her. love for love. You took Nastasya Philipovna from him. He will murder Aglaya Ivanovna, for though she is not yours, of course, now, still such an act would pain you, wouldn't it?" He had attained his end. The prince left the house beside himself with terror. These warnings about Rogojin were expressed on the day before the wedding. That evening the prince saw Nastasya Philipovna for the last time before they were to meet at the altar, but Nastasya was not in a position to give him any comfort or consolation. On the contrary, she only added to his mental perturbation as the evening went on. Up to this time she had invariably done her best to cheer him. She was afraid of his looking melancholy. She would try singing to him, and telling him every sort of funny story or reminiscence that she could recall. The prince nearly always pretended to be amused, whether he were so actually or no. But often enough he laughed sincerely, delighted by the brilliancy of her wit when she was carried away by her narrative, as she very often was. Nastasya would be wild with joy to see the impression she had made, and to hear his laugh of real amusement, and she would remain the whole evening in a state of pride and happiness. But this evening her melancholy and thoughtfulness grew with every hour. The prince had told Evgeny Pavlovitch, with perfect sincerity, that he loved Nastasya Philipovna with all his soul. In his love for her there was the sort of tenderness one feels for a sick, unhappy child which cannot be left alone. He never spoke of his feelings for Nastasya to anyone, not even to herself. When they were together they never discussed their feelings, and there was nothing in their cheerful, animated conversation which an outsider could not have heard. Darya Alexeyevna, with whom Nastasya was staying, told afterwards how she had been filled with joy and delight only to look at them, all this time. Thanks to the manner in which he regarded Nastasya's mental and moral condition, the prince was to some extent freed from other perplexities. She was now quite different from the woman he had known 3 months before. He was not astonished, for instance, to see her now so impatient to marry him, she who formerly had wept with rage and hurled curses and reproaches at him if he mentioned marriage. "It shows that she no longer fears, as she did then, that she would make me unhappy by marrying me," he thought. And he felt sure that so sudden a change could not be a natural one. This rapid growth of self-confidence could not be due only to her hatred for Aglaya. To suppose that would be to suspect the depth of her feelings. Nor could it arise from dread of the fate that awaited her if she married Rogojin. These causes, indeed, as well as others, might have played a part in it, but the true reason, Muishkin decided, was the one he had long suspected, that the poor sick soul had come to the end of its forces. Yet this was an explanation that did not procure him any peace of mind. At times he seemed to be making violent efforts to think of nothing, and one would have said that he looked on his marriage as an unimportant formality, and on his future happiness as a thing not worth considering. As to conversations such as the one held with Evgeny Pavlovitch, he avoided them as far as possible, feeling that there were certain objections to which he could make no answer. The prince had observed that Nastasya knew well enough what Aglaya was to him. He never spoke of it, but he had seen her face when she had caught him staring off for the Epanchins' house on several occasions. When the Epanchins left Pavlovsk, she had beamed with radiance and happiness. Unsuspicious and unobservant as he was, he had feared at that time that Nastasya might have some scheme in her mind for a scene or scandal which would drive Aglaya out of Pavlovsk. She had encouraged the rumours and excitement among the inhabitants of the place as to her marriage with the prince in order to annoy her rival, and, finding it difficult to meet the Epanchins anywhere, she had, on one occasion, taken him for a drive past their house. He did not observe what was happening until they were almost passing the windows, when it was too late to do anything. He said nothing, but for 2 days afterwards he was ill. Nastasya did not try that particular experiment again. A few days before that fixed for the wedding, she grew grave and thoughtful. She always ended by getting the better of her melancholy, and becoming merry and cheerful again, but not quite so unaffectedly happy as she had been some days earlier. The prince redoubled his attentive study of her symptoms. It was a most curious circumstance, in his opinion, that she never spoke of Rogojin. But once, about 5 days before the wedding, when the prince was at home, a messenger arrived begging him to come at once, as Nastasia Philipovna was very ill. He had found her in a condition approaching to absolute madness. She screamed and trembled and cried out that Rogojin was hiding out there in the garden, that she had seen him herself, and that he would murder her in the night, that he would cut her throat. She was terribly agitated all day. But it so happened that the prince called at Hippolyte's house later on, and heard from his mother that she had been in town all day, and had there received a visit from Rogojin, who had made inquiries about Pavlovsk. On inquiry, it turned out that Rogojin visited the old lady in town at almost the same moment when Nastasia declared that she had seen him in the garden, so that the whole thing turned out to be an illusion on her part. Nastasia immediately went across to Hippolyte's to inquire more accurately, and returned immensely relieved and comforted. On the day before the wedding, the prince left Nastasia in a state of great animation. Her wedding dress and all sorts of finery had just arrived from town. Muishkin had not imagined that she would be so excited over it, but he praised everything, and his praise rendered her doubly happy. But Nastasia could not hide the cause of her intense interest in her wedding splendor. She had heard of the indignation in the town, and knew that some of the populace was getting up a sort of charivari with music, that verses had been composed for the occasion, and that the rest of Pavlovsk society more or less encouraged these preparations. So, since attempts were being made to humiliate her, she wanted to hold her head even higher than usual, and to overwhelm them all with the beauty and taste of her toilet. "Let them shout and whistle if they dare!" Her eyes flashed at the thought. But, underneath this, she had another motive, of which she did not speak. She thought that possibly Aglaya, or at any rate someone sent by her, would be present incognito at the ceremony, or in the crowd, and she wished to be prepared for this eventuality. The prince left her at 11, full of these thoughts, and went home. But it was not 12 o'clock when a messenger came to say that Nastasia was very bad, and he must come at once. On hurrying back, he found his bride locked up in her own room, and could hear her hysterical cries and sobs. It was some time before she could be made to hear that the prince had come, and then she opened the door only just sufficiently to let him in, and immediately locked it behind him. She then fell on her knees at his feet. So at least Dana Alexeyevna reported. "What am I doing? What am I doing to you?" she sobbed convulsively, embracing his knees. The prince was a whole hour soothing and comforting her, and left her, at length, pacified and composed. He sent another messenger during the night to inquire after her, and two more next morning. The last brought back a message that Nastasia was surrounded by a whole army of dressmakers and maids, and was as happy and as busy as such a beauty should be on her wedding morning, and that there was not a vestige of yesterday's agitation remaining. The message concluded with the news that at the moment of the bearer's departure, there was a great confabulation in progress as to which diamonds were to be worn and how. This message entirely calmed the prince's mind. The following report of the proceedings on the wedding day may be depended upon, as coming from eyewitnesses. The wedding was fixed for 8 o'clock in the evening. Nastasia Philipovna was ready at 7. From 6 o'clock, groups of people began to gather at Nastasia's house, at the prince's, and at the church door, but more especially at the former place. The church began to fill at 7. Kolya and Vera Lebedev were very anxious on the prince's account, but they were so busy over the arrangements for receiving the guests after the wedding that they had not much time for the indulgence of personal feelings. There were to be very few guests besides the best men and so on, only Dana Alexeyevna, the Pitsons, Gania, and the doctor. When the prince asked Lebedev why he had invited the doctor, who was almost a stranger, Lebedev replied, "Why, he wears an order, and it looks so well." This idea amused the prince. Keller and Berdovsky looked wonderfully correct in their dress coats and white kid gloves, although Keller caused the bridegroom some alarm by his undisguisedly hostile glances at the gathering crowd of sightseers outside. At about 7:30, the prince started for the church in his carriage. We may remark here that he seemed anxious not to omit a single one of the recognized customs and traditions observed at weddings. He wished all to be done as openly as possible and in due order. Arrived at the church, Muishkin, under Keller's guidance, passed through the crowd of spectators, amid continuous whispering and excited exclamations. The prince stayed near the altar, while Keller made off once more to fetch the bride. On reaching the gate of Darya Alexeyevna's house, Keller found a far denser crowd than he had encountered at the prince's. The remarks and exclamations of the spectators here were of so irritating a nature that Keller was very near making them a speech on the impropriety of their conduct, but was luckily caught by Burdovsky in the act of turning to address them, and hurried indoors. Nastasia Philipovna was ready. She rose from her seat, looked into the glass, and remarked, as Keller told the tale afterwards, that she was as pale as a corpse. She then bent her head reverently before the icon in the corner, and left the room. A torrent of voices greeted her appearance at the front door. The crowd whistled, clapped its hands, and laughed and shouted, but in a moment or two isolated voices were distinguishable. "What a beauty!" cried one. "Well, she isn't the first in the world, nor the last," said another. "Marriage covers everything," observed a third. "I defy you to find another beauty like that," said a fourth. "She's a real princess. I'd sell my soul for such a princess as that." Nastasia came out of the house looking as white as any handkerchief, but her large dark eyes shone upon the vulgar crowd like blazing coals. The spectators' cries were redoubled and became more exultant and triumphant every moment. The door of the carriage was open, and Keller had given his hand to the bride to help her in, when suddenly, with a loud cry, she rushed from him, straight into the surging crowd. Her friends about her were stupefied with amazement. The crowd parted as she rushed through it, and suddenly, at a distance of 5 or 6 yards from the carriage, appeared Rogojin. It was his look that had caught her eyes. Nastasia rushed to him like a madwoman and seized both his hands. "Save me!" she cried. "Take me away! Anywhere you like! Quick!" Rogojin seized her in his arms and almost carried her to the carriage. Then, in a flash, he tore a 100-ruble note out of his pocket and held it to the coachman. "To the station! Quick! If you catch the train, you shall have another! Quick!" He leaped into the carriage after Nastasia and banged the door. The coachman did not hesitate a moment. He whipped up the horses and they were off. "One more second and I should have stopped him," said Keller afterwards. In fact, he and Burdovsky jumped into another carriage and set off in pursuit. But it struck them as they drove along that it was not much use trying to bring Nastasia back by force. "Besides," said Burdovsky, "the prince would not like it, would he?" So they gave up the pursuit. Rogojin and Nastasia Philipovna reached the station just in time for the train. As he jumped out of the carriage and was almost on the point of entering the train, Rogojin accosted a young girl standing on the platform and wearing an old-fashioned but respectable-looking black cloak and a silk handkerchief over her head. "Take 50 rubles for your cloak," he shouted, holding the money out to the girl. Before the astonished young woman could collect her scattered senses, he pushed the money into her hand, seized the mantle, and threw it and the handkerchief over Nastasia's head and shoulders. The latter's wedding array would have attracted too much attention, and it was not until some time later that the girl understood why her old cloak and kerchief had been bought at such a price. The news of what had happened reached the church with extraordinary rapidity. When Keller arrived, a host of people whom he did not know thronged around to ask him questions. There was much excited talking, and shaking of heads, even some laughter. But no one left the church, all being anxious to observe how the now celebrated bridegroom would take the news. He grew very pale upon hearing it, but took it quite quietly. "I was afraid," he muttered, scarcely audibly, "but I hardly thought it would come to this." Then, after a short silence, he added, "However, in her state, it is quite consistent with the natural order of things." Even Keller admitted afterwards that this was extraordinarily philosophical on the prince's part. He left the church quite calm, to all appearances, as many witnesses were found to declare afterwards. He seemed anxious to reach home and be left alone as quickly as possible, but this was not to be. He was accompanied by nearly all the invited guests, and besides this, the house was almost besieged by excited bands of people who insisted upon being allowed to enter the veranda. The prince heard Keller and Lebedev remonstrating and quarrelling with these unknown individuals, and soon went out himself. He approached the disturbers of his peace, requested courteously to be told what was desired, then politely putting Lebedev and Keller aside, he addressed an old gentleman who was standing on the veranda steps at the head of the band of would-be guests, and courteously requested him to honour him with a visit. The old fellow was quite taken aback by this, but entered, followed by a few more, who tried to appear at their ease. The rest remained outside, and presently the whole crowd was censuring those who had accepted the invitation. The prince offered seats to his strange visitors, tea was served, and a general conversation sprang up. Everything was done most decorously, to the considerable surprise of the intruders. A few tentative attempts were made to turn the conversation to the events of the day, and a few indiscreet questions were asked. But Mushkin replied to everybody with such simplicity and good humour, and at the same time with so much dignity, and showed such confidence in the good breeding of his guests, that the indiscreet talkers were quickly silenced. By degrees the conversation became almost serious. One gentleman suddenly exclaimed, with great vehemence, "Whatever happens, I shall not sell my property. I shall wait. Enterprise is better than money, and there, sir, you have my whole system of economy, if you wish." He addressed the prince, who warmly commended his sentiments, though Lebedev whispered in his ear that this gentleman, who talked so much of his property, had never had either house or home. Nearly an hour passed thus, and when tea was over, the visitors seemed to think that it was time to go. As they went out, the doctor and the old gentleman bade Mushkin a warm farewell, and all the rest took their leave with hearty protestations of goodwill, dropping remarks to the effect that it was no use worrying, and that perhaps all would turn out for the best, and so on. Some of the younger intruders would have asked for champagne, but they were checked by the older ones. When all had departed, Keller leaned over to Lebedev and said, "With you and me there would have been a scene. We should have shouted and fought, and called in the police. But he has simply made some new friends, and such friends, too. I know them." Lebedev, who was slightly intoxicated, answered with a sigh, "Things are hidden from the wise and prudent, and revealed unto babes. I have applied those words to him before, but now I add that God has preserved the babe himself from the abyss, he and all his saints." At last, about 10:30, the prince was left alone. His head ached. Kolya was the last to go, after having helped him to change his wedding clothes. They parted on affectionate terms, and, without speaking of what had happened, Kolya promised to come very early the next day. He said later that the prince had given no hint of his intentions when they said goodbye, but had hidden them even from him. Soon there was hardly anyone left in the house. Berdovsky had gone to see Hippolyte, Keller and Lebedev had wandered off together somewhere. Only Vera Lebedev remained hurriedly rearranging the furniture in the rooms. As she left the veranda, she glanced at the prince. He was seated at the table, with both elbows upon it, and his head resting on his hands. She approached him and touched his shoulder gently. The prince started and looked at her in perplexity. He seemed to be collecting his senses for a minute or so, before he could remember where he was. As recollection dawned upon him, he became violently agitated. All he did, however, was to ask Vera very earnestly to knock at his door and awake him in time for the first train to Petersburg next morning. Vera promised, and the prince entreated her not to tell anyone of his intention. She promised this too, and at last, when she had half closed the door, he called her back a third time, took her hands in his, kissed them, then kissed her forehead, and in a rather peculiar manner said to her, "Until tomorrow." Such was Vera's story afterwards. She went away in great anxiety about him, but when she saw him in the morning, he seemed to be quite himself again, greeted her with a smile, and told her that he would very likely be back by the evening. It appears that he did not consider it necessary to inform anyone excepting Vera of his departure for town. End of chapter 10.
Chapter 11 of Part 4 of The Idiot, Parts 3 and 4, by Fyodor Dostoevsky. Translated by Eva M. Martin. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. An hour later he was in St. Petersburg, and by 10 o'clock he had rung the bell at Rogojin's. He had gone to the front door and was kept waiting a long while before anyone came. At last the door of old Mrs. Rogojin's flat was opened, and an aged servant appeared. "Parfen Semyonovitch is not at home," she announced from the doorway. "Whom do you want?"
"Parfen Semyonovitch."
"He is not in." The old woman examined the prince from head to foot with great curiosity. "At all events, tell me whether he slept at home last night, and whether he came alone." The old woman continued to stare at him, but said nothing. "Was not Nastasia Philipovna here with him yesterday evening?"
"And pray, who are you yourself?"
"Prince Lef Nikolaevich Mushkin. He knows me well."
"He is not at home."
The woman lowered her eyes. "And Nastasia Philipovna?"
"I know nothing about it."
"Stop a minute. When will he come back?"
"I don't know that either."
The door was shut with these words, and the old woman disappeared. The prince decided to come back within an hour. Passing out of the house, he met the porter. "Is Parfen Semyonovitch at home?" he asked.
"Yes."
"Why did they tell me he was not at home, then?"
"Where did they tell you so? At his door?"
"No, at his mother's flat. I rang at Parfen Semyonovitch's door, and nobody came."
"Well, he may have gone out. I can't tell. Sometimes he takes the keys with him and leaves the rooms empty for 2 or 3 days."
"Do you know for certain that he was at home last night?"
"Yes, he was."
"Was Nastasia Philipovna with him?"
"I don't know. She doesn't come often. I think I should have known if she had come."
The prince went out deep in thought and walked up and down the pavement for some time. The windows of all the rooms occupied by Rogojin were closed. Those of his mother's apartments were open. It was a hot, bright day. The prince crossed the road in order to have a good look at the windows again. Not only were Rogojin's closed, but the white blinds were all down as well. He stood there for a minute, and then, suddenly and strangely enough, it seemed to him that a little corner of one of the blinds was lifted, and Rogojin's face appeared for an instant and then vanished. He waited another minute, and decided to go and ring the bell once more. However, he thought better of it again, and put it off for an hour. The chief object in his mind at this moment was to get as quickly as he could to Nastasia Philipovna's lodging. He remembered that, not long since, when she had left Pavlovsk at his request, he had begged her to put up in town at the house of a respectable widow, who had well-furnished rooms to let, near the Ismailovsky barracks. Probably Nastasia had kept the rooms when she came down to Pavlovsk this last time, and most likely she would have spent the night in them, Rogojin having taken her straight there from the station. The prince took a droshky. It struck him as he drove on that he ought to have begun by coming here, since it was most improbable that Rogojin should have taken Nastasia to his own house last night. He remembered that the porter said she very rarely came at all, so that it was still less likely that she would have gone there so late at night. Vainly trying to comfort himself with these reflections, the prince reached the Ismailovsky barracks more dead than alive. To his consternation, the good people at the lodgings had not only heard nothing of Nastasia, but all came out to look at him as if he were a marvel of some sort. The whole family, of all ages, surrounded him, and he was begged to enter. He guessed at once that they knew perfectly well who he was, and that yesterday ought to have been his wedding day, and further, that they were dying to ask about the wedding, and especially about why he should be here now, inquiring for the woman who in all reasonable human probability might have been expected to be with him in Pavlovsk. He satisfied their curiosity, in as few words as possible, with regard to the wedding, but their exclamations and sighs were so numerous and sincere that he was obliged to tell the whole story, in a short form, of course. The advice of all these agitated ladies was that the prince should go at once and knock at Rogojin's until he was let in, and when let in, insist upon a substantial explanation of everything. If Rogojin was really not at home, the prince was advised to go to a certain house, the address of which was given, where lived a German lady, a friend of Nastasia Philipovna's. It was possible that she might have spent the night there, in her anxiety to conceal herself. The prince rose from his seat in a condition of mental collapse. The good ladies reported afterwards that his pallor was terrible to see, and his legs seemed to give way underneath him. With difficulty he was made to understand that his new friends would be glad of his address, in order to act with him if possible. After a moment's thought he gave the address of the small hotel, on the stairs of which he had had a fit some 5 weeks since. He then set off once more for Rogojin's. This time they neither opened the door at Rogojin's flat nor at the one opposite. The prince found the porter with difficulty, but when found, the man would hardly look at him or answer his questions, pretending to be busy. Eventually, however, he was persuaded to reply so far as to state that Rogojin had left the house early in the morning and gone to Pavlovsk, and that he would not return today at all. "I shall wait. He may come back this evening."
"He may not be home for a week."
"Then at all events, he did sleep here, did he?"
"Well, he did sleep here, yes."
All this was suspicious and unsatisfactory. Very likely the porter had received new instructions during the interval of the prince's absence. His manner was so different now. He had been obliging. Now he was as obstinate and silent as a mule. However, the prince decided to call again in a couple of hours, and after that to watch the house, in case of need. His hope was that he might yet find Nastasia at the address which he had just received. To that address he now set off at full speed. But alas, at the German lady's house they did not even appear to understand what he wanted. After a while, by means of certain hints, he was able to gather that Nastasia must have had a quarrel with her friend 2 or 3 weeks ago, since which date the latter had neither heard nor seen anything of her. He was given to understand that the subject of Nastasia's present whereabouts was not of the slightest interest to her, and that Nastasia might marry all the princes in the world for all she cared. So Muishkin took his leave hurriedly. It struck him now that she might have gone away to Moscow just as she had done the last time, and that Rogojin had perhaps gone after her, or even with her. If only he could find some trace. However, he must take his room at the hotel, and he started off in that direction. Having engaged his room, he was asked by the waiter whether he would take dinner. Replying mechanically in the affirmative, he sat down and waited. But it was not long before it struck him that dining would delay him. Enraged at this idea, he started up, crossed the dark passage, which filled him with horrible impressions and gloomy forebodings, and set out once more for Rogojin's. Rogojin had not returned, and no one came to the door. He rang at the old lady's door opposite, and was informed that Parfen Semyonovitch would not return for 3 days. The curiosity with which the old servant stared at him again impressed the prince disagreeably. He could not find the porter this time at all. As before, he crossed the street and watched the windows from the other side, walking up and down in anguish of soul for half an hour or so in the stifling heat. Nothing stirred. The blinds were motionless. Indeed, the prince began to think that the apparition of Rogojin's face could have been nothing but fancy. Soothed by this thought, he drove off once more to his friends at the Ismailovsky barracks. He was expected there. The mother had already been to 3 or 4 places to look for Nastasia, but had not found a trace of any kind. The prince said nothing, but entered the room, sat down silently, and stared at them, one after the other, with the air of a man who cannot understand what is being said to him. It was strange. One moment he seemed to be so observant, the next so absent. His behavior struck all the family as most remarkable. At length he rose from his seat and begged to be shown Nastasia's rooms. The ladies reported afterwards how he had examined everything in the apartments. He observed an open book on the table, Madame Bovary, and requested the leave of the lady of the house to take it with him. He had turned down the leaf at the open page and pocketed it before they could explain that it was a library book. He had then seated himself by the open window, and seeing a card table, he asked who played cards. He was informed that Nastasia used to play with Rogojin every evening, either at Preference or Little Fool or Whist, that this had been their practice since her last return from Pavlovsk, that she had taken to this amusement because she did not like to see Rogojin sitting silent and dull for whole evenings at a time, that the day after Nastasia had made a remark to this effect, Rogojin had whipped a pack of cards out of his pocket. Nastasia had laughed, but soon they began playing. The prince asked where were the cards, but was told that Rogojin used to bring a new pack every day, and always carried it away in his pocket. The good ladies recommended the prince to try knocking at Rogojin's once more, not at once, but in the evening. Meanwhile, the mother would go to Pavlovsk to inquire at Dana Alexeyevna's whether anything had been heard of Nastasia there. The prince was to come back at 10 o'clock and meet her, to hear her news and arrange plans for the morrow. In spite of the kindly meant consolations of his new friends, the prince walked to his hotel in inexpressible anguish of spirit, through the hot, dusty streets, aimlessly staring at the faces of those who passed him. Arrived at his destination, he determined to rest a while in his room before he started for Rogojin's once more. He sat down, rested his elbows on the table and his head on his hands, and fell to thinking. Heaven knows how long and upon what subjects he thought. He thought of many things, of Vera Lebedev and of her father, of Hippolyte, of Rogojin himself, first at the funeral, then as he had met him in the park, then, suddenly, as they had met in this very passage, outside, when Rogojin had watched in the darkness and awaited him with uplifted knife. The prince remembered his enemy's eyes as they had glared at him in the darkness. He shuddered, as a sudden idea struck him. This idea was that if Rogojin were in Petersburg, though he might hide for a time, yet he was quite sure to come to him, the prince, before long, with either good or evil intentions, but probably with the same intention as on that other occasion. At all events, if Rogojin were to come at all, he would be sure to seek the prince here. He had no other town address, perhaps in this same corridor. He might well seek him here if he needed him. And perhaps he did need him. This idea seemed quite natural to the prince, though he could not have explained why he should so suddenly have become necessary to Rogojin. Rogojin would not come if all were well with him. That was part of the thought. He would come if all were not well. And certainly, undoubtedly, all would not be well with him. The prince could not bear this new idea. He took his hat and rushed out towards the street. It was almost dark in the passage. "What if he were to come out of that corner as I go by and stop me?" thought the prince as he approached the familiar spot. But no one came out. He passed under the gateway and into the street. The crowds of people walking about, as is always the case at sunset in Petersburg during the summer, surprised him, but he walked on in the direction of Rogojin's house. About 50 yards from the hotel, at the first crossroad, as he passed through the crowd of foot passengers sauntering along, someone touched his shoulder and said in a whisper into his ear, "Lef Nikolaevitch, my friend, come along with me." It was Rogojin. The prince immediately began to tell him, eagerly and joyfully, how he had but the moment before expected to see him in the dark passage of the hotel. "I was there," said Rogojin unexpectedly. "Come along." The prince was surprised at this answer, but his astonishment increased a couple of minutes afterwards when he began to consider it. Having thought it over, he glanced at Rogojin in alarm. The latter was striding along a yard or so ahead, looking straight in front of him, and mechanically making way for anyone he met. "Why did you not ask for me at my room if you were in the hotel?" asked the prince suddenly. Rogojin stopped and looked at him, then reflected and replied as though he had not heard the question. "Look here, Lef Nikolaevitch, you go straight on to the house. I shall walk on the other side. See that we keep together." So saying, Rogojin crossed the road. Arrived on the opposite pavement, he looked back to see whether the prince were moving, waved his hand in the direction of the Gorohovaya, and strode on, looking across every moment to see whether Muishkin understood his instructions. The prince supposed that Rogojin desired to look out for someone whom he was afraid to miss. But if so, why had he not told him who to look out for? So the two proceeded for half a mile or so. Suddenly the prince began to tremble from some unknown cause. He could not bear it, and signaled to Rogojin across the road. The latter came at once. "Is Nastasya Philipovna at your house?" "Yes." "And was it you looked out of the window under the blind this morning?"
"Yes."
"Then why did—" But the prince could not finish his question. He did not know what to say. Besides this, his heart was beating so that he found it difficult to speak at all. Rogojin was silent also, and looked at him as before, with an expression of deep thoughtfulness.
"Well, I'm going," he said, at last, preparing to recross the road. "You go along here as before. We will keep to different sides of the road. It's better so. You'll see."
When they reached the Gorohovaya and came near the house, the prince's legs were trembling so that he could hardly walk. It was about 10 o'clock. The old lady's windows were open, as before. Rogojin's were all shut, and in the darkness the white blinds showed whiter than ever. Rogojin and the prince each approached the house on his respective side of the road. Rogojin, who was on the near side, beckoned the prince across. He went over to the doorway.
"Even the porter does not know that I have come home now. I told him, and told them at my mother's too, that I was off to Pavlovsk," said Rogojin, with a cunning and almost satisfied smile. "We'll go in quietly, and nobody will hear us."
He had the key in his hand. Mounting the staircase, he turned and signaled to the prince to go more softly. He opened the door very quietly, let the prince in, followed him, locked the door behind him, and put the key in his pocket.
"Come along," he whispered.
He had spoken in a whisper all the way. In spite of his apparent outward composure, he was evidently in a state of great mental agitation. Arrived in a large salon, next to the study, he went to the window and cautiously beckoned the prince up to him.
"When you rang the bell this morning, I thought it must be you. I went to the door on tiptoe and heard you talking to the servant opposite. I had told her before that if anyone came and rang, especially you, and I gave her your name, she was not to tell about me. Then I thought, what if he goes and stands opposite and looks up, or waits about to watch the house? So I came to this very window, looked out, and there you were staring straight at me. That's how it came about."
"Where is Nastasya Philipovna?" asked the prince, breathlessly.
"She's here," replied Rogojin, slowly, after a slight pause.
"Where?"
Rogojin raised his eyes and gazed intently at the prince. "Come," he said. He continued to speak in a whisper, very deliberately as before, and looked strangely thoughtful and dreamy. Even while he told the story of how he had peeped through the blind, he gave the impression of wishing to say something else. They entered the study. In this room some changes had taken place since the prince last saw it. It was now divided into two equal parts by a heavy green silk curtain stretched across it, separating the alcove beyond, where stood Rogojin's bed, from the rest of the room. The heavy curtain was drawn now, and it was very dark. The bright Petersburg summer nights were already beginning to close in, and but for the full moon, it would have been difficult to distinguish anything in Rogojin's dismal room, with the drawn blinds. They could just see one another's faces, however, though not in detail. Rogojin's face was white, as usual. His glittering eyes watched the prince with an intent stare.
"Had you not better light a candle?" said Muishkin.
"No, I needn't," replied Rogojin, and taking the other by the hand, he drew him down to a chair.
He himself took a chair opposite and drew it up so close that he almost pressed against the prince's knees. At their side was a little round table.
"Sit down," said Rogojin. "Let's rest a bit."
There was silence for a moment.
"I knew you would be at that hotel," he continued, just as men sometimes commence a serious conversation by discussing any outside subject before leading up to the main point. "As I entered the passage, it struck me that perhaps you were sitting and waiting for me, just as I was waiting for you. Have you been to the old lady at Ismailovsky Barracks?"
"Yes," said the prince, squeezing the word out with difficulty owing to the dreadful beating of his heart.
"I thought you would. They'll talk about it, I thought, so I determined to go and fetch you to spend the night here. We will be together, I thought, for this one night."
"Rogojin, where is Nastasia Philipovna?" said the prince, suddenly rising from his seat. He was quaking in all his limbs, and his words came in a scarcely audible whisper. Rogojin rose also.
"There," he whispered,
nodding his head towards the curtain.
"Asleep?"
whispered the prince. Rogojin looked intently at him again, as before.
"Let's go in, but you mustn't... Well, let's go in."
He lifted the curtain, paused, and turned to the prince.
"Go in,"
he said, motioning him to pass behind the curtain. Mushkin went in.
"It's so dark," he said. "You can see quite enough," muttered Rogojin.
"I can just see there's a bed."
"Go nearer," suggested Rogojin, softly.
The prince took a step forward, then another, and paused. He stood and stared for a minute or two. Neither of the men spoke a word while at the bedside. The prince's heart beat so loud that its knocking seemed to be distinctly audible in the deathly silence. But now his eyes had become so far accustomed to the darkness that he could distinguish the whole of the bed. Someone was asleep upon it, in an absolutely motionless sleep. Not the slightest movement was perceptible, not the faintest breathing could be heard. The sleeper was covered with a white sheet. The outline of the limbs was hardly distinguishable. He could only just make out that a human being lay outstretched there. All around, on the bed, on a chair beside it, on the floor, were scattered the different portions of a magnificent white silk dress, bits of lace, ribbons, and flowers. On a small table at the bedside glittered a mass of diamonds, torn off and thrown down anyhow. From under a heap of lace at the end of the bed peeped a small white foot, which looked as though it had been chiseled out of marble. It was terribly still. The prince gazed and gazed, and felt that the more he gazed, the more deathlike became the silence. Suddenly a fly awoke somewhere, buzzed across the room, and settled on the pillow. The prince shuddered.
"Let's go," said Rogojin, touching his shoulder.
They left the alcove and sat down in the two chairs they had occupied before, opposite to one another. The prince trembled more and more violently, and never took his questioning eyes off Rogojin's face.
"I see you are shuddering, Lef Nikolaevitch," said the latter at length, "almost as you did once in Moscow before your fit. Don't you remember? I don't know what I shall do with you."
The prince bent forward to listen, putting all the strain he could muster upon his understanding in order to take in what Rogojin said, and continuing to gaze at the latter's face. "Was it you?" he muttered at last, motioning with his head towards the curtain.
"Yes, it was I," whispered Rogojin, looking down.
Neither spoke for 5 minutes.
"Because, you know," Rogojin recommenced, as though continuing a former sentence, "if you were ill now, or had a fit, or screamed, or anything, they might hear it in the yard, or even in the street, and guess that someone was passing the night in the house. They would all come and knock and want to come in, because they know I am not at home. I didn't light a candle for the same reason. When I am not here, for 2 or 3 days at a time, now and then, no one comes in to tidy the house or anything. Those are my orders. So that I want them to not know we are spending the night here."
"Wait," interrupted the prince. "I asked both the porter and the woman whether Nastasia Philipovna had spent last night in the house. So they knew—"
"I know you asked. I told them that she had called in for 10 minutes, and then gone straight back to Pavlovsk. No one knows she slept here. Last night we came in just as carefully as you and I did today. I thought as I came along with her that she would not like to creep in so secretly, but I was quite wrong. She whispered, and walked on tiptoe. She carried her skirt over her arm so that it shouldn't rustle, and she held up her finger at me on the stairs, so that I shouldn't make a noise. It was you she was afraid of. She was mad with terror in the train, and she begged me to bring her to this house. I thought of taking her to her rooms at the Izhmaylovsky barracks first, but she wouldn't hear of it. She said, 'No, not there. He'll find me out at once there. Take me to your own house, where you can hide me, and tomorrow we'll set off for Moscow.' Thence she would go to Orel, she said. When she went to bed, she was still talking about going to Orel. 'Wait, what do you intend to do now, Parfen?' 'Well, I'm afraid of you. You shudder and tremble so. We'll pass the night here together. There are no other beds besides that one. But I've thought how we'll manage. I'll take the cushions off all the sofas and lay them down on the floor, up against the curtain here, for you and me, so that we shall be together. For if they come in and look about now, you know, they'll find her and carry her away, and they'll be asking me questions, and I shall say I did it, and then they'll take me away too, don't you see? So let her lie close to us, close to you and me.' 'Yes, yes,' agreed the prince warmly. 'So we will not say anything about it, or let them take her away?' 'Not for anything,' cried the other. 'No, no, no.' 'So I had decided, my friend, not to give her up to anyone,' continued Rogojin. 'We'll be very quiet. I have only been out of the house 1 hour all day. All the rest of the time I have been with her. I dare say the air is very bad here. It is so hot. Do you find it bad?'
'I don't know. Perhaps. By morning it will be.'
'I've covered her with oilcloth, best American oilcloth, and put the sheet over that, and 4 jars of disinfectant on account of the smell, as they did at Moscow. You remember? And she's lying so still. You shall see in the morning when it's light.' 'What, can't you get up?' asked Rogojin, seeing the other was trembling so that he could not rise from his seat. 'My legs won't move,' said the prince. 'It's fear, I know. When my fear is over, I'll get up.' 'Wait a bit. I'll make the bed, and you can lie down.' 'I'll lie down, too, and will listen and watch, for I don't know yet what I shall do. I tell you beforehand, so that you may be ready in case I—' Muttering these disconnected words, Rogojin began to make up the beds. It was clear that he had devised these beds long before. Last night he slept on the sofa, but there was no room for 2 on the sofa, and he seemed anxious that he and the prince should be close to one another. Therefore, he now dragged cushions of all sizes and shapes from the sofas, and made a sort of bed of them close by the curtain. He then approached the prince and gently helped him to rise, and led him towards the bed. But the prince could now walk by himself, so that his fear must have passed. For all that, however, he continued to shudder.
'It's hot weather, you see,' continued Rogojin, as he lay down on the cushions beside Mushkin. 'And, naturally, there will be a smell. I daren't open the window. My mother has some beautiful flowers in pots. They have a delicious scent. I thought of fetching them in, but that old servant will find out. She's very inquisitive.'
'Yes, she is inquisitive,' assented the prince.
'I thought of buying flowers and putting them all around her, but I was afraid it would make us sad to see her with flowers round her.'
'Look here,' said the prince. He was bewildered, and his brain wandered. He seemed to be continually groping for the questions he wished to ask, and then losing them. 'Listen, tell me. How did you—' 'With a knife? That same one?'
'Yes, that same one.'
'Wait a minute. I want to ask you something else, Parfen. All sorts of things. But tell me first. Did you intend to kill her before my wedding, at the church door, with your knife?'
'I don't know whether I did or not,' said Rogojin dryly, seeming to be a little astonished at the question, and not quite taking it in.
'Did you never take your knife to Pavlovsk with you?'
'No. As to the knife,' he added, 'this is all I can tell you about it.'
He was silent for a moment, and then said,
'I took it out of the locked drawer this morning about 3. For it was in the early morning all this—happened. It has been inside the book ever since, and—this is what is such a marvel to me. The knife only went in a couple of inches at most, just under her left breast, and there wasn't more than 1/2 tablespoonful of blood altogether, not more.'
'Yes, yes, yes!' The prince jumped up in extraordinary agitation. 'I know, I know. I've read of that sort of thing. It's internal hemorrhage, you know.
Sometimes there isn't a drop, if the blow goes straight to the heart."
"Wait, listen," cried Rogojin, suddenly starting up. "Somebody's walking about, do you hear? In the hall."
Both sat up to listen.
"I hear," said the prince in a whisper, his eyes fixed on Rogojin.
"Footsteps?"
"Yes." "Shall we shut the door and lock it, or not?"
"Yes, lock it." They locked the door and both lay down again. There was a long silence.
"Yes, by the by,"
whispered the prince, hurriedly and excitedly as before, as though he had just seized hold of an idea and was afraid of losing it again.
I wanted those cards. They say you played cards with her?"
"Yes, I played with her," said Rogojin, after a short silence.
"Where are the cards?"
"Here they are," said Rogojin, after a still longer pause. He pulled out a pack of cards, wrapped in a bit of paper, from his pocket, and handed them to the prince. The latter took them, with a sort of perplexity. A new, sad, helpless feeling weighed on his heart. He had suddenly realized that not only at this moment, but for a long while, he had not been saying what he wanted to say, had not been acting as he wanted to act, and that these cards which he held in his hand, and which he had been so delighted to have at first, were now of no use. No use! He rose and wrung his hands. Rogojin lay motionless and seemed neither to hear nor see his movements, but his eyes blazed in the darkness and were fixed in a wild stare. The prince sat down on a chair and watched him in alarm. Half an hour went by. Suddenly Rogojin burst into a loud, abrupt laugh, as though he had quite forgotten that they must speak in whispers.
"That officer, eh? That young officer! Don't you remember that fellow at the band, eh? Ha ha ha! Didn't she whip him smartly, eh?"
The prince jumped up from his seat in renewed terror. When Rogojin quieted down, which he did at once, the prince bent over him, sat down beside him, and with painfully beating heart and still more painful breath, watched his face intently. Rogojin never turned his head, and seemed to have forgotten all about him. The prince watched and waited. Time went on. It began to grow light. Rogojin began to wander, muttering disconnectedly. Then he took to shouting and laughing. The prince stretched out a trembling hand and gently stroked his hair and his cheeks. He could do nothing more. His legs trembled again, and he seemed to have lost the use of them. A new sensation came over him, filling his heart and soul with infinite anguish. Meanwhile the daylight grew full and strong, and at last the prince lay down, as though overcome by despair, and laid his face against the white, motionless face of Rogojin. His tears flowed onto Rogojin's cheek, though he was perhaps not aware of them himself. At all events, when, after many hours, the door was opened and people thronged in, they found the murderer unconscious and in a raging fever. The prince was sitting by him, motionless, and each time that the sick man gave a laugh or a shout, he hastened to pass his own trembling hand over his companion's hair and cheeks, as though trying to soothe and quiet him. But alas, he understood nothing of what was said to him, and recognized none of those who surrounded him. If Schneider himself had arrived then and seen his former pupil and patient, remembering the prince's condition during the first year in Switzerland, he would have flung up his hands despairingly and cried as he did then, "An idiot!" End of chapter 11. Chapter 12 of Part 4 of The Idiot, Parts 3 and 4, by Fyodor Dostoevsky. Translated by Eva M. Martin. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. When the widow hurried away to Pavlovsk, she went straight to Darya Alexeyevna's house, and, telling all she knew, threw her into a state of great alarm. Both ladies decided to communicate at once with Lebedev, who, as the friend and landlord of the prince, was also much agitated. Vera Lebedev told all she knew, and by Lebedev's advice it was decided that all three should go to Petersburg as quickly as possible, in order to avert what might so easily happen.
This is how it came about that at 11 o'clock next morning Rogojin's flat was opened by the police in the presence of Lebedev, the two ladies, and Rogojin's own brother, who lived in the wing. The evidence of the porter went further than anything else towards the success of Lebedev in gaining the assistance of the police. He declared that he had seen Rogojin return to the house last night, accompanied by a friend, and that both had gone upstairs very secretly and cautiously. After this there was no hesitation about breaking open the door, since it could not be got open in any other way. Rogojin suffered from brain fever for 2 months. When he recovered from the attack, he was at once brought up on trial for murder. He gave full, satisfactory, and direct evidence on every point, and the prince's name was, thanks to this, not brought into the proceedings. Rogojin was very quiet during the progress of the trial. He did not contradict his clever and eloquent counsel, who argued that the brain fever, or inflammation of the brain, was the cause of the crime, clearly proving that this malady had existed long before the murder was perpetrated, and had been brought on by the sufferings of the accused. But Rogojin added no words of his own in confirmation of this view, and as before, he recounted with marvellous exactness the details of his crime. He was convicted, but with extenuating circumstances, and condemned to hard labour in Siberia for 15 years. He heard his sentence grimly, silently, and thoughtfully. His colossal fortune, with the exception of the comparatively small portion wasted in the first wanton period of his inheritance, went to his brother, to the great satisfaction of the latter. The old lady, Rogojin's mother, is still alive, and remembers her favourite son Parfen sometimes, but not clearly. God spared her the knowledge of this dreadful calamity which had overtaken her house. Lebedev, Keller, Gania, Pitsen, and many other friends of ours continue to live as before. There is scarcely any change in them, so that there is no need to tell of their subsequent doings. Hippolyte died in great agitation, and rather sooner than he expected, about a fortnight after Nastasia Philipovna's death. Kolya was much affected by these events, and drew nearer to his mother in heart and sympathy. Nina Alexandrovna is anxious, because he is thoughtful beyond his years, but he will, we think, make a useful and active man. The prince's further fate was more or less decided by Kolya, who selected, out of all the persons he had met during the last 6 or 7 months, Evgeny Pavlovitch, as friend and confidant. To him he made over all that he knew as to the events above recorded, and as to the present condition of the prince. He was not far wrong in his choice. Evgeny Pavlovitch took the deepest interest in the fate of the unfortunate idiot, and thanks to his influence, the prince found himself once more with Dr. Schneider in Switzerland. Evgeny Pavlovitch, who went abroad at this time, intending to live a long while on the continent, being, as he often said, quite superfluous in Russia, visits his sick friend at Schneider's every few months. But Dr. Schneider frowns ever more and more, and shakes his head. He hints that the brain is fatally injured. He does not as yet declare that his patient is incurable, but he allows himself to express the gravest fears. Evgeny takes this much to heart, and he has a heart, as is proved by the fact that he receives and even answers letters from Kolya. But besides this, another trait in his character has become apparent, and as it is a good trait, we will make haste to reveal it. After each visit to Schneider's establishment, Evgeny Pavlovitch writes another letter, besides that to Kolya, giving the most minute particulars concerning the invalid's condition. In these letters is to be detected, and in each one more than the last, a growing feeling of friendship and sympathy. The individual who corresponds thus with Evgeny Pavlovitch, and who engages so much of his attention and respect, is Vera Lebedev. We have never been able to discover clearly how such relations sprang up. Of course the root of them was in the events which we have already recorded, and which so filled Vera with grief on the prince's account that she fell seriously ill. But exactly how the acquaintance and friendship came about, we cannot say.
We have spoken of these letters chiefly because in them is often to be found some news of the Epanchin family, and of Aglaya in particular. Evgeny Pavlovitch wrote of her from Paris that after a short and sudden attachment to a certain Polish count, an exile, she had suddenly married him, quite against the wishes of her parents, though they had eventually given their consent through fear of a terrible scandal. Then, after a 6 months' silence, Evgeny Pavlovitch informed his correspondent, in a long letter, full of detail, that while paying his last visit to Dr. Schneider's establishment, he had there come across the whole Epanchin family, excepting the general, who had remained in St. Petersburg, and Prince S. The meeting was a strange one. They all received Evgeny Pavlovitch with effusive delight. Adelaida and Alexandra were deeply grateful to him for his angelic kindness to the unhappy prince. Lizabetha Prokofievna, when she saw poor Muishkin in his enfeebled and humiliated condition, had wept bitterly. Apparently all was forgiven him. Prince S. had made a few just and sensible remarks. It seemed to Evgeny Pavlovitch that there was not yet perfect harmony between Adelaida and her fiancé, but he thought that in time the impulsive young girl would let herself be guided by his reason and experience. Besides, the recent events that had befallen her family had given Adelaida much to think about, especially the sad experiences of her younger sister. Within 6 months, everything that the family had dreaded from the marriage with the Polish count had come to pass. He turned out to be neither count nor exile, at least in the political sense of the word, but had had to leave his native land owing to some rather dubious affair of the past. It was his noble patriotism, of which he made a great display, that had rendered him so interesting in Aglaya's eyes. She was so fascinated that, even before marrying him, she joined a committee that had been organized abroad to work for the restoration of Poland, and further, she visited the confessional of a celebrated Jesuit priest who made an absolute fanatic of her. The supposed fortune of the count had dwindled to a mere nothing, although he had given almost irrefutable evidence of its existence to Lizabetha Prokofievna and Prince S. Besides this, before they had been married half a year, the count and his friend the priest managed to bring about a quarrel between Aglaya and her family, so that it was now several months since they had seen her. In a word, there was a great deal to say, but Mrs. Epanchin and her daughters, and even Prince S., were still so much distressed by Aglaya's latest infatuations and adventures that they did not care to talk of them, though they must have known that Evgeny knew much of the story already. Poor Lizabetha Prokofievna was most anxious to get home, and, according to Evgeny's account, she criticized everything foreign with much hostility. "They can't bake bread anywhere decently, and they all freeze in their houses during winter, like a lot of mice in a cellar. At all events, I've had a good Russian cry over this poor fellow," she added, pointing to the prince, who had not recognized her in the slightest degree. "So enough of this nonsense. It's time we faced the truth. All this continental life, all this Europe of yours, and all the trash about going abroad is simply foolery, and it is mere foolery on our part to come. Remember what I say, my friend. You will live to agree with me yourself." So spoke the good lady, almost angrily, as she took leave of Evgeny Pavlovitch. End of Part 4, Chapter 12, and End of The Idiot, Parts 3 and 4, by Fyodor Dostoevsky, translated by Eva M. Martin. Read by Jan Morehouse of Smith River, California.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.